Welcome to Men Are Nuts, a podcast about mental health, emotional health, physical health, psychological health, awareness in men, women, and society. First, it started with men, the acronym for Men Are Nuts. And we have a very special guest on the show for you today. We've just been speaking beforehand, and I'm sure it's been a few weeks now we've been trying to kind of get times together and kind of work things out, and even just now is just, you know, things happening. In fact, just introduce yourself.
So I'm Vinny Webbione, based in the UK, currently a detective working in Surrey Police.
Right, so you're a detective in Surrey Police. And it sounds obvious, but are you actually in Surrey now, where you are now then? Yeah, because the reason why I asked that is because I spoke to a police officer the other day a former police officer who said he lived in Hartlepool, but then he was actually doing his work in Middlesbrough. So for the listeners out there, what is Surrey like? Is, you know, what is it? Is it a county? Is it a city? What's it like?
Surrey Police is a county which covers a vast area. It's in the south part of London, below London, and it has quite a large affluent area, and it borders other counties such as Kent, Sussex, Hampshire, and it has a transport link going into London, but also down to the coast as well. And it's often seen like a family force to work with. So majority of the people that work within it, whether they're police officers or police staff, feel part of or belong to the organisation.
Yeah, so it's quite community-based.
It is, yeah.
Yeah, and for the listeners out there, are you actually at work now? Obviously, that wouldn't be...
I am, yeah.
For listeners out there, just for a bit of joke, I can see on the back of his wall, he's a detective, and I can see there's loads of as you see on the movies where you see there's loads of pictures and he's trying to find out of a case. Not really, but yeah. So, you're based in Surrey. What's it like to live? I mean, you spoke about it's the actual surrounding area. Is it part rural? You say you can. Is transport links? Is it quite rural? Is it quite city life? What is it like?
So, in various areas of the county, you'll get your towns and your big towns. So you've got Guildford, you've got Staines, you've got Reigate, and so they'll be your urban areas of Surrey, and then you'll have your rural areas, and there's a vast amount of rural areas in Surrey, and they bring their own sort of challenges to policing.
And how long have you been in the force? I mean, how long have you been part of it?
So I've been a police officer for 19 years. I worked in the Met for 8 of those years, the Metropolitan Police in London, and then I transferred to Surrey Police back in 2009, and I've been with Surrey Police since.
Yeah. Were you born in Surrey or London, or where were you born?
Yeah, so I was born in London, sort of the northwest part of London, and grew up in sort of Wembley, Kilburn, Harlesden area.
Yeah, fantastic. And I've invited you on just to, you know, we're talking about mental health and you know, your journey and how you're finding life at the moment. How are you finding things with these, not just as a personal level, but as a person working for the force? How you found things in the last year with what's been happening, particularly with the pandemic? And
I think since COVID first began back in I think it originally began in 2019 December, but when we actually started seeing a significant increase in sort of January, February, and then we had our lockdown, it was a fast shift to how we worked. Police had to do a big, massive response to it, And then we were guided by what the government had put in place.
Yeah.
And then we were constantly shifting how we responded as the government shifted in what they were wanting to have the country doing, I guess, at that time. Relevant to, I think, mental health, I think almost instantly, within weeks and months, we began seeing responding to a lot more calls connected with mental health. And the impacts of what COVID itself was having on individuals, but then the sort of new formed of people on top of each other, because they wouldn't normally be on top of each other at home because they were in lockdown at the house. So ordinarily one person would go to work and then only be spending a short period of time together, either couples, families, etc., rather than the whole sort of whole morning and day and evening, as part of it. And then not being able to go out and do their daily runs, park, you know, visits, attractions, etc. So yeah, it was a real shift in. I mean, it challenged me at points, but I mean, I had an outlet where I was able to go out and work, because certainly in the UK we were classed as what we call key workers, and I was able to go out and go into the office and do my day-to-day work. So it was a lot easier for myself. I think it would have had a slightly higher impact on my wife, because she was at home as well as working and as well as homeschooling children at the same time. So our challenges were slightly different, and you know, I had to be aware of that when I went back home to sort of take over where so I can give her a bit of respite.
And you know, when you said the shift, obviously there would be a shift in terms of the, maybe the calls, the type of calls or the range of calls that are coming in or coming out, or the things that you've heard. And also, like you say, the government. Would you say that there was a? Would you say that you was there any points where you kind of caught between two stools, where you're acting in terms of what the government would say, but then based on your job and what you've done before, you'd be thinking, oh, maybe I should be doing it like this. I mean, was there any point in terms?
There was always a conflict of decision making because you know, we're out there, and we, and certainly in the UK, do policing by consent, and we work with the community and try and engage with them, and to then have these regulations put in place, and then we had guidance around what we call the four E's, where we explain, engage, encourage before we enforce. And you know, there came times where we had to make difficult decisions, and sometimes enforcement was one of the only outcomes that we could do to sort of manage it. But often that then got exploded into the media, saying that we were being overbearing to our community, and then that then had sort of like a reverse effect, and then we wouldn't do it, and then we then got told off for not doing it, and then we got told to do it, and you know, it was almost like a yo-yo effect, I guess, from that aspect. But in the main, I think nearly every officer I've worked with had the opportunity to work with during the COVID period very much took a common sense approach. And if someone was breaching a COVID regulation, and they were innocently didn't know anything about, you know, the ins and outs of the evolving changes of the regulation, they will be fair and give them a warning and sort of move them on and just remind them not to do what they were doing. But if we had situations where people were blatantly flouting the regulation and travelling long distances, or, you know, they'd been stopped by the same officer a number of times and they were breaching it, then they will get a ticket. And I think we've been quite fortunate in Surrey just to make sure that we've had that sort of management around sort of COVID and regulations and tickets. But it has been difficult. I mean, you know, for officers, certainly working on a day-to-day basis, where we're facing criminals, and then officers are getting spat at, coughed at, and then comments made around, oh, I've just passed on COVID to you, and the knock-on impact of that in terms of mental health, like we're talking about, and the conversations I've had to have with my staff to help manage what has happened and help them process what they've gone through whilst they wait for results around their negative, etc., is huge. I mean, I remember one of my shifts that I was doing, I had a call from two members of my staff that had been spat and coughed at. One of the officers, his wife was due to be giving birth to their newborn child, and if he'd been tested positive, he wouldn't have been able to go into the hospital. And there's just that 1, 2, 3 days where they were just waiting for results.
Panicking and
massive trauma.
Panicking and worrying. And I've spoken to people, you know, people in armed forces, in the police, and first responders, and, you know, like I say, I want everybody to come on this podcast. And what people, you know, fail to realise is that it's the impact of. I'm not talking. Okay, you go and rob. You're robbing a bank. Okay, that can have implications in other ways. But it's things like what you're saying there of being spat at or coughed at, particularly with this happening. It's the impact of that. It's not on just on you, but it's your surrounding family. Like you said, the connective thing there is the surrounding family. And we don't realise what people in the force have gone through and are going through on a daily basis. You seem like a person who's upbeat and you smile a lot and cheery. How's it impacted you this last year? You know, you said about the, you know, having to go home and homeschool and all that sort of stuff, you know, and you maybe even perhaps look after your wife or whoever else. How's it impacted you on a personal level?
I think because the restrictions have sort of made you think inwards a lot more, and because you've had because I've had the opportunity to be by myself and reflect a lot more, whereas I've not been busy. I don't know, I tend to find myself getting distracted quite a lot doing other projects, like we discussed outside, the many that you've done. But I think I quickly get myself put into situations where I'm trying to do different projects, probably to distract them. But I guess I've been quite fortunate because in 2019, my father passed away back in January. And I guess it took about a month and a half, 2 months before that emotional wall hit me, I guess. I made contact with a counselling service, and probably one of the best things I ever did, because after a number of telephone calls, it was decided that face-to-face back then, before COVID, face-to-face counselling sessions were going to be a good way forward. And I think my sixth session must have been some of my most powerful sessions, because I think not only was I able to process the grief of my father, who died through cancer, but it sort of brought out almost 35 years of feelings that were trapped. And we talk about men's mental health, and I think it is that sort of thing we have, that we want to just suppress all of those feelings. And I was just layering them and layering them and layering them, and I think looking back now, I think the frustrations that I've had historically would have been attributed to those feelings, but I didn't want to attribute them to the feelings because I thought I'd be weak, etc. And when I went through the counselling sessions, I was able to then start bringing layer by layer, my feelings to the surface.
Yeah.
And as I brought them to the surface, there was feelings that I had towards my brother, in a negative sense, that I hadn't processed, and our relationship as a result of it had been impacted. It was feelings that I had around racial comments that were made against me outside the organisation, and the whole talk, it all sort of compounded together, and having an outlet through counselling and a framework that they provided me helped build up some resilience in me. So when coming into COVID, aside from work being a helpful distractor, because I don't think it impacted me as much as it impacted my wife and others who had gone on furlough and had to be at home, I guess, because I was still working. So it was almost like normality. But I was policing the whole impact of it.
Right.
So in terms of the impact on me was more around how I was seeing how it was impacting others. Because I coach others, I can sort of put myself into their shoes, and then sort of beginning to sort of listen to them and talk to them through it. I almost felt what they were going through as a result of it, and it led me to sort of start concentrating my coaching into helping people build their resilience, helping people build their confidence so that they can move forward. So people had lost their jobs, people were who had been in like a 20, 30 year career had lost their jobs and they didn't know anything different. So it was helping people that helped me get through and process through, I guess, empathy.
I was going to say that, the sympathy and the empathy of you, not just as a person, but and not just you as a detective or a, you know, former police officer or whatever it may be. It's, this is about you and how your, how things have impacted you. And I was going to say to you, you know, when, you know, before we start talking about, you know, your kind of journey, would you say that the, not just you being a man, but you being in the police force and being a detective and you've seen so much, do you think that's also part of the thing that kind of kept you from talking about, you know, your father and that time where you didn't grieve or whatever? Do you find that that's part of it as well, not just you being a man, but you being, you've seen so much and done, you've seen so many things that it kind of when I've spoken to people, they've seen things that have traumatized them and they've seen different things. Do you see what I mean? And it's kind of...
Yeah, I think I've come hardy.
You're not strong as a...
I think I've come hardy.
Yeah, hardened. Hardened, that's a word.
Yeah, so I've come hardened. And I think when I first started policing, everything used to be like an impact, a shock. And when it was the first time I dealt with an incident, it had an impact on me physiologically and psychologically. But the more I dealt with that same type of incident or scenario, the feelings almost became paralyzed, I guess.
Yeah.
So I wasn't able to. So, you know, when I did a good 1.5-2 years on the murder team, in the Met. And seeing a dead body and seeing death. So whenever I went to funerals, death wasn't really an emotional impact, because I saw death on a day-to-day basis. Or when I was in the domestic abuse team or the child protection team, you know, seeing that every day had an impact. We had to get psychological assessments on a frequent basis to make sure that we were still our health and well-being and our mindfulness was at a level that we can continue doing that work. So we're protected by the organisation in that sense that they were looking after our mind when we were dealing with those types of jobs. But no doubt it has had an impact in how I can process feelings, because as a police officer, I have to be quite objective around what I do. So and I do everything in a sort of problem-solving way. So everything's in a quite a logical way.
Yeah.
So whenever something happens at home, I almost go into autopilot of how I would be at work, and I just compartmentalize everything and then deal with it in a logical way, and often find myself and certainly members of family and friends saying, I'm not a victim or I'm not a suspect, why are you talking to me like that? And I think to a degree, I think when I started coaching and learning how to coach, that has helped me, because the sort of primary aspect of it is around the agenda of others, and learning how to listen with empathy and extreme empathy. So you really are not thinking about anything else but what you're listening to.
I found that's one of the reasons why I've worked with so many people of different ages, and I'm able to. I'm still able to do that now. I'm able to, you know, I've worked in conjunction with the police. I've worked with the police, and I'm able to connect with people and young people and you know, in a way, is that it's not just the logical thing. It's the empathy and the sympathy, and you're looking at every, say case on its merit, and every situation is different. So even if somebody has, two people have depression, they haven't gone through the same thing to get that depression, because they're two different people. And at what time did they get depression, and what time, you know, and what level? So you're right in terms of what you're doing is helping people. Let's talk about your journey growing up and you as a boy, young boy, and because what I'm trying to get a feeling is how you became who you are, and isn't just because this thing of helping people isn't happening now. Yes, it's a culmination of the therapist talking to you, but there's something in you, because someone could speak to you, a therapist can speak to you, and you might not be the person who wants to help people. Do you see what I mean? So there's got to be something in your personality that, and it's got to be something, is it something from your upbringing? So let's talk about your journey and you as a child and where you grew up, and what, why did you want to become police, or, and did you want to become a police officer before?
Well, this will be the interesting part. Funny you asked. So, like I said, I was born in London, grew up in sort of northwest London, and Wembley in particular. And growing up was, you know, I look back and I guess I was fortunate, mum, dad in the household. I was part of your typical Asian family, where they were quite culturally grounded. When you're young, you are just expected to follow that culture. You get told you're going to a temple, and you ask why, and you're just going and that's what's happening. I went with the flow, I guess, when I was younger. School was a really good upbringing. I had a good set of friends at school, some of whom I stay in touch with now, which is really, really good, and are good contacts that certainly when I'm needing to just run something through that I can trust, that's not connected to some of the work I'm doing, really able to give them a call. School was an up and down. I did get bullied at school, primarily around colour and being different. I did react and almost got expelled, I guess, from school. But fortunately, I think they recognised that I was the victim from it.
What was your kind of, if you can remember, what was your kind of first experience in terms of racial or, you know, racial bullying? What was your kind of first experience, if you can remember? Or what kind of bullying were you getting?
Mostly comments. So, you know, people would call the word packy out on a regular basis. They were throwing stones, you know, when you're bicycling around the area, like beyond your sort of immediate street. I guess more so in the sort of council estate aspects of it. I mean, that was quite a fucking call. Probably when I was in high school, the transition between junior school and high school, I would say that's when it was sort of began. And you'd get the school ground sort of the playground sort of bullying as well, which never not always touched upon the racial aspect, but sometimes touched upon, I guess, the nerd type aspect of bullying as well. And, you know, some of my best mates today are white male individuals from school. My best mate at the time at school was a white male who we always used to hang around with. You know, we supported the same football team, went to the same football matches and
what
stuff like that.
What team was that then? What team was that?
Tottenham Hotspur.
Tottenham Hotspur. I thought you were going to say Tottenham. Yeah.
But I remember the days when we, his dad used to take us, and we used to take crates with us, so we'd stand on the crates so that we could have the north and the south stand of the standing.
Who was playing in that era?
So it was the likes of Mabba, Hoddle Waddle, Aussie Idealist.
So you went to what? You was watching them at that time?
Yeah.
Oh God, yeah.
I remember Klinsmann being on the team.
Gosh.
And watching Klinsmann, it was brilliant. I absolutely loved it. Ginola, it was brilliant times. You know, the walk up from Seven Sisters to White Hart Lane, and all the stuff that we loved it. And I guess looking back, because my dad wasn't into football, and he really wasn't that type of person, I sort of saw his dad as almost my social type dad, because he was a dad, and they were the family that took me to these sort of football matches, and where I got those, I guess, growing up as a boy, kid experiences that people who did have that sort of experience naturally in their family would have done.
And was that something that you, what did you want to be when you grew up? At that age, and did you want to be a footballer, or because you wanted to play football? What did you want to be?
I didn't know whether I was wanting to be a footballer, it was one of those, I was always nearly picked right at the end when it was squad picking time, until there was a transition. When I was at high school, I think it was about year three or year four, where I was playing as goalkeeper for the B team.
Right.
And out of a clean sheet, where we scored 13-0, I think.
Yeah.
The PE teacher at the time said, I think I might want to try out for our A team.
Right.
And then I got tried out for the A team, and I had a clean sheet for like three games. So I'd knocked the A-team goalkeeper off the A-team became the A-team goalkeeper. And it was a time when I think he was trying to get QPR to come down and watch.
Right.
To see if I was any good to join their camp, I guess.
Yeah.
Which excited me quite a bit at that time. Nothing came out of it. Otherwise, would I have been? If I had the talent and I had the support, probably,
yeah.
I think I probably would have gone for it. If someone else saw it, I don't think I naturally would have pushed for it. I was quite academic at the time.
Yeah,
and stuck with my I never really, I mean, average grades really, never really sort of sparked anything, but I was probably more academic. I mean, I did other sports. I played cricket, football, I played table tennis. I started playing table tennis fairly early on, where I played, was able to play league table tennis at a league level. But yeah, really enjoyed my sports, but not at a, I guess at a professional level, but more of a sort of league type level.
So you're quite a sporty kid then, really.
Pardon me?
You're quite a sporty kid then.
I enjoyed my sport.
So, as you hit your teenage, was there any thoughts of doing any? Was there anything that you know, wanted to do, or you know, were you kind of being coaxed into it by your parents, or was there anything that you wanted to do, or you saw a role model that maybe wanted to get do?
So, that I guess this is where our culture sort of comes to its light, where there's an expectation. You're either going to be a doctor, dentist, accountant, business person, and almost that was the sort of tunnel of vocations, I should say. So, you know, I started working for Currys at the time when I was about 17, just to get some Saturday money in. And that really just steered the type of mindset. You know, I was either going to be financially, I was either going to be dental, medical, etc. So I ended up having a chat with our careers officer, thinking about what I was going to do, and I ended up steering for dental technology. So I built everything up and then went to college for doing dental technology, which is effectively making dental appliances, so like braces, crowns, bridges. So I trained for 3 years at college. And then had the opportunity to go for a degree in the same field at Sheffield University. So I was able to apply and then got successfully accepted to go and do the degree. And that opened up a much wider opportunity for me. So not only was it that I was doing dental stuff, but I was doing medical science as well. So we were learning, and so I was broadening my sort of science sphere. then I thought, what am I going to do next? And I started getting into this rhythm around academic work, and I was going to be an academic. So I'd already done my bachelor's 2 years in, and I was thinking, well, what am I going to do next? So I was then planning to do my master's, so continuing on that theme, and applied for a place at UCL to do forensic archaeology. So I applied to do forensic archaeology, got accepted, so that now began to cement my sort of career in academic work. And I did that for a year, and during that process, I think, well, the next natural step is a PhD after a master's. So I applied, and I applied because I wanted to do something different. So I applied to Toronto, University of Toronto, to do forensic anthropology. And I was communicating with them, and by that time, I was probably about, what, £40,000-£45,000 in debt as a student. And they were saying all the right things, and they wanted me, but I couldn't get into Canada because of the debt I had.
Canada has a different system.
They have a scoring system. So that began to start putting quite a number of barriers in terms of what I wanted to do. And I probably could have done a PhD in the UK if I sort of put my mindset to it. But then I thought, I've got $45,000 in debt. I need to start paying some of this off. We had an input by a company called Caligate at the time. It's changed now, but they were a forensic imagery company, and they gave an input to us students, and that they must have spoken to the tutors, and they highlighted and they sort of wanted me to work for their company.
Yeah.
So they talent spotted and wanted me to work for their company. And I thought, even before I finished university, I've got a job offer.
Yeah.
So I thought, right, let's start talking and start getting into it. So so I took them up on that offer so I can start getting some money, but also start working in the field that I've done some work in, forensics. And then I began working for Callaghan. They were based in St. Neots in Cambridgeshire.
Yeah,
and then I moved out from London where I was to a place called Bulldog in Hertfordshire, and I would travel to work. But there I would do a lot of work around looking at facial mapping, imagery, CCTV, and trying to get sent for police forces. Because they were doing investigations where a suspect would have committed a crime, and they wanted us to say, is this the person that committed the crime that's seen on the CCTV? And we would write reports for them, present cases to court. And I remember being at a conference in Glasgow, and there was two Met detective sergeants at the time, and it was for the British Association of Human Identifiers, one of who I was a part of back then. And they began talking around their role as police officers, but as crime scene investigators, effectively.
Yeah.
And managers. And I thought, oh, quite like the sound of that.
Yeah.
Something that I might want to do. And the company I was working for at the time had said that they were going to give me partnership and various other aspects to the job. And they weren't coming to fruition, even after the year.
Yeah.
So I then had to make a decision around what I was going to do, what I wanted to do. And then spoke to these DSs, and they said, well, you could do this. You could do what I'm doing. And I said, well, how long would it take? And he said, oh, you need to join policing. You need to do your 2 years walking the beat.
Yeah, yeah.
You need to become a detective. You need to become a sergeant. And then you need to become a detective sergeant so you can then apply for this role.
Right.
So roughly how long would that take? So they said, oh, it'll take about 5-6 years. I said, well, that's not a bad plan.
Yeah.
So at that time, my best man for my wedding, he was already in the police. So I began running it past him. And he said, do it, you should do it. You're Asian, they'll rip your hand off. Joining the police.
Yeah.
That sort of became the trigger of applying for the police. So I never really... up until that point, the thought never really crossed my mind of becoming a police officer.
Yeah.
It was never in my radar whatsoever. So I applied, and the process was quite a weird experience for me, I must admit. It's split up in two ways, where you do your verbal reasoning and your sort of maths, English type tests first to see if you're able to pass that aspect of it before you then go to do a physical test. And I remember the sort of verbal reasoning parts being held in October time, and then being told that I'd passed that, I got a date to do my physical test in January.
Yeah.
And it was the early part of January, first week after the holidays in January. Back in 2001, I think it was. 2002, where I sat it. I remember going into the physical, past the physical, and then we give our certificates and show all our qualifications, etc. The most weirdest experience I ever had was, there was two white males, and they were giving their certificates, and I was sitting on the desk waiting to sit down and give mine. And one of them said, when are we likely to start our training? One of the admin staff said, you'll be looking at around November, December time.
Yeah.
So bearing in mind we were January at that time, and all three of us went with a sigh, oh, was that long? So they'd delivered their certificates and they'd left the room. And then it was me in my room, me in the room by myself with the admin staff. And we began talking and they started talking to me. And obviously, because I had my degrees, etc., they said, have you thought about doing the fast track promotion? I said, no. I want to get in and do the lights and all that sort of stuff and have some fun before I start making a decision about my career. Still thinking, I'm not going to be starting until November, you know. And there was a quick moment of pause, and I remember seeing he turned over the folder, turned it back again, and said, "You're all right, son. You're going to start in February." And that's when I began to think there was difference involved. And I was already being treated differently compared to others. And that gave me a bit of a throwback in, and it had gave me a knockback in confidence, effectively, because it then sort of, I guess, laid down this sort of foundation that whatever I'm going to go for is going to be based on I'm different. And then it's going to be perceived by others
as
that it's just because I'm different. And I guess that that's gone through me throughout my whole career. Even though I know that I've the jobs that I've got on my own merit, my own mindset has said other people are thinking this, even though they're not. Even though they're not. And then that has a knock-on impact on imposter syndrome and all the other bits and pieces that have subsequently sort of crept in over the years as a result of it. But so I did, I joined and started my training in February 2002, finished and then joined Brent Borough, and really enjoyed the life of policing. But I still had that plan of 5 years. So, you know, I was doing my training and sat my sergeant's exam in my probation, passed it, and then started preparing to becoming a detective so I can get that ticket in, and did everything within the time frame. And policing as it is, and it's evolving, civilianized the job that I was going for. So it was no longer a police officer's role, but a police staff's role. So then I had to make a real big decision. Do I relinquish my role as a police officer and then to become a police staff to take on that role? Or do I stay as a police officer? And because of all the learning that I was getting, the enjoyment I was having doing the role, and you know, the I know it sounds a bit cliche, but what I was giving back to the community, I enjoyed. So I stayed as a police officer, and then everything I've done and all the sort of opportunities that I've had and the work that I've done has led me to where I am, but with all the I guess underbelly stuff of emotional stuff that I've had to carry, which thankfully was I was able to sort of begin to release from a tragic event that happened in my life with my dad, losing my dad. But that was like almost a catalyst for helping me get rid of all the other stuff that came about with it. But you know, there was times where I'd faced racism outside the organisation. I can't say that I had it overtly inside the organisation where people have made those physical comments from within. You know, I might have felt it where there was that underground, underbelly type, but it certainly hasn't presented itself. In fact, one of the I think angriest moments I had was when it came from my own community. And I heard comments around, oh, he's a coconut. And that really, really infuriated me, thinking that, you know, I've got more support from the people within my organisation, my policing family, than I did from you know, comments that I got from my outside of the family. And it was almost like a, I see where we are now in terms of some of my cousins and extended family, and where they really truly see me. And I don't think they quite, I don't think they knew I heard it.
Right. I see. So you got you. So, it wasn't directly. It wasn't directly said at you. It was kind of something that was said and you overheard.
Yeah. So I was around the corner from when the conversations were happening.
Yeah.
And then when you walk in that environment, you feel.
It changes. It's funny, you know, because when you mentioned then about feeling, so funny. It's funny to hear somebody say it now. It's growing up as a man of color, black man, melanated man, and people often said, you know, when you say, oh yeah, I just feel it. They don't. It's something that they don't. It's almost like they don't get it. Obviously, they wouldn't get it. But when we, like you're saying there, you feel it. You do feel when you're in an environment that either one person or several people in this room are looking at you differently or feel a certain way towards you based on your colour of skin. Because you might not even have opened your mouth. You might not have even said anything. It's just this feeling that you get when you walk in the room, maybe. I don't know what it is. I mean, I'm laughing now because it's funny because I've grown up with that. And that feeling and saying it, you know, you're just feeling people, oh, you're walking around with a chip on your shoulder. You're thinking, well, no, I'm not, because I'm quite a down-to-earth person and I have feelings too. So I was going to say as well, there's a success story as well in that, what you're saying there is that although you felt these things and you're feeling these things and the imposter syndrome and that's another side to it, there's almost a success story there because, not almost success, there is. Because if you think back to when you were bullied and you were bullied based on the colour of your skin, it's almost like, ha, look at me. You're not feeling that, but it's almost like, well, look at me now. You see what I mean? I've got somewhere, and yes, I was bullied, but it didn't stop me. Do you know what I mean? You've stopped me now by throwing stones at me and calling me names and getting me upset and almost getting expelled. It's almost been part of the catalyst for me now. Look at me now. I've got over that. Not got over it, but I've managed to come through that to where I am, to the position that you're in now, would you say?
Yeah, and I think you're absolutely right. I think my turning point around my mindset was when I was at college, when I left school and went to college, and I was surrounded by mature people.
Yeah.
And I guess where I didn't get the opportunity to share that with my dad, say for example, or my mum, because of the limitations of them not understanding what I was going through as a first generation UK kid.
Yeah.
I was able to lean on people that are around me. So I had a really good network of friends, or almost like, so my best man was almost like a real good confidant for me, where I could share in support, you know, help where he could, and help me sort of rationalize some of the stuff that I was going through, where I wouldn't be able to share it or with my dad or my mum at the time. And I think looking back now, I think it was at that period of time, certainly when I was at college and meeting these people who have influenced my life to where it is now. And if I hadn't had that, I don't know where I would be.
Yeah. That's another thing I speak about on the podcast, is people who have been able to access other people. Like you say, people are now, it's funny because now people are now accessing you. You've accessed some you've accessed others, and then now you've turned it around. It almost like turned around again. Life goes around in circles, doesn't it? We know it because the clock and everything like that, and you know the wheels on the car. It takes you forward, and it can take you backwards, and it can take you forward. But it life works in circles, and you've been able to access something, and then people are now accessing you based on the cycle of life, would you say?
Yeah, I mean, it's exactly that. And I think because I've been grateful for what I've had and the guidance that I've had, I'm more generous with my time to give it to others. Generosity, so overwhelming that I'll do sessions with people even at work when I'm not working. Because I have this innate need to help others and help others succeed. Because someone has provided that trigger point or that catalyst to help me do it.
And that's the reason why I kind of went back into you to talk to have, you know, growing up, and it's where did that come from? And I can see where it's you know, even the bit to do with the getting from the B team to the A team, it's when you said that, you smiled, and it brought out a, do you know what I mean, memories of you, you know, maybe stopping a shot or whatever it may be, and it's somebody's took the time out to recognize you, even throughout the bullying and all the stone throwing, to recognize you as you step on up to this another level. I'm just thinking out because I like success stories, you see, and I like the fact that helping people, and I can see where success stories come from, in terms of, like you said, it could have, you know, in that moment I saw you smiling, so you could have been thinking, oh yes, I remember that, you know, I remember being a kid, or I remember being a rainy day or whatever it may be, and I was in goal and stopping these shots and things like that. So those things are, we need people to help us, don't we? We need people. We're not just here on our own. We need people to help us, whether it may be someone who may be struggling mentally, maybe someone who's, you know, whatever, committed a crime, they might have struggled, you know, through life, or, you know, whatever it may be, or even on that day, it might be drugs or whatever it may be. We need people to understand what made us do the things that we do or about to do. What are some of the things, I was going to ask you about, just about your father as well. Did you find that when your father passed, was the thoughts of there's things I wish I told him, or I could have told him, and
100%.
Because I'm getting
unresolved.
Getting that from you because of some of the things you said, something about there's things that you didn't say or you couldn't say to your mum and dad that you could say to confide him. There's nothing wrong with that, but sometimes we go back and think, oh, I wish we could have said that to him, you know, because my I never had a male role model, and the closest person to it was my godfather, who died last year, and I couldn't really speak. I could, but it wasn't that relationship where I could, you know, every single detail I could tell him about my life or whatever. Would you say that's a fair point?
Yeah, and I think I think my dad was my dad was a carpenter by trade, and he was a very, very skillful master craftsman at his trade. He was always busy, but that was his life. And almost anything outside that, I felt was insignificant.
Right.
So, and it almost every time I would have a conversation with him about other stuff other than carpentry or woodworking or the trade, there would be like a yes-no conversation going on, and it would be limited. Where if it was a conversation around the trade, like you say, you sort of smile. It was an engagement, it lasted a lot longer. And you know, it encouraged me to take part. And I think in his mind, he wanted me to be a carpenter in the trade. And I think the moment that step went away, and he knew I wasn't going to be, I think our relationship slightly changed. I guess, and because my brother, younger brother, hadn't really had the academic aspect, but was more probably practical. I mean, his is a different story because he got into the world of crime for a short period of time. So there's a lot of challenges with my brother. But I think he would talk and work with my brother a little bit more than he would with me. And because he was the youngest of the four of us, it was always he was the well looked after one. It felt it anyway. And even up until when he passed, it was that type of conversation. So, you know, sharing that I passed my exams or I got promoted or anything like that would still be like a sterile yes and no type of conversation. And then when I was talking about an extension I was getting done in the house, suddenly the conversation exploded and went, oh, have you thought about this? Have you done this? Have you made sure that this is done? And I'm thinking, so there was an element of I wish he was able to talk to me more about the feeling stuff. And being there as the feeling dad, and I guess I do that more with my kids now because I think I didn't have that for myself. So I always make it a key point to sort of sit down and just make sure that my son and my daughter are looked after from that perspective.
How's your relationship? You know, obviously don't think it, but I mean, how was your relationship with your brothers? You know, how has it been, and how is it knowing that you felt that way toward, you know, in terms of, you know, the way your dad spoke and he saw some, you know, the favourite, or, you know, the favourite, because because I know.
Oh, it was definitely a green moment. I wouldn't overtly say it, but I think my sister helped rationalise it a lot later on. But it was, you know, internally, it was definitely a green moment. You know, he'd get opportunities that I probably wouldn't get opportunities for. He'd talk to my brother more than I would. Even though, you know, the sort of times where my brother was had interactions with the police in a negative way as well, I would often be seen as the fixer, go and sort your brother out type thing. So then I was always seen as from a negative light from my brother. Because I was always talking about the negative with him. So we had a really, I guess growing up until that point where he was making bad choices. And unhealthy choices. It was an okay child upbringing, good child upbringing, and then things changed. So when he began to make unhealthy choices, our relationship changed, and it was always an aspect of he saw me as the kid that was always the high achiever, and mom and dad liked me, and I saw him as the one that mom and dad. Liking him more than me, aspect of it, and there was an element of back in, I think it was 2004. I remember being in policing and stopping a couple of people in the sort of Kilburn Halsden area, and then saying, "We know where you live," type scenario, and I was like saying, "Yeah, whatever," and then them reeling off the door number, the colour of the door, the street, and everything like that. And it was like a big, harsh reality of, oh my God, my family could be at risk. So without really telling the family, my brother and everyone, why I was moving away from the house and buying my own house and stuff like that, I kept it to myself, and so I moved out. So in their eyes, They felt I was disbanding the family because I was the oldest son, and in our culture, you know, the oldest son stays with the family. Yeah. In their eyes, they thought I was abandoning the family. But I could never bring myself to work up to tell them why I was doing it, because I didn't want them to feel at risk.
So you're protecting them. You're protecting them, and they're not feeling protected, which is...
Absolutely. So then I moved that, and then my relationship with my brother stayed fractious and remained fractious for a long period of time, up until when Dad died. So when Dad died, and I went through my counselling, I was counselled to deal with the smaller stuff, to then get myself strong enough to deal with the bigger stuff. And in my plan, I should say, I guess, in my sort of OCD, sort of problem-solving police officer mindset, I left my brother's conversation right till the end, right. Because it was the greatest conversation that I was going to have. I guess my sister helped sort of rationalise quite a lot of some of the stuff, and helped me not be angry, and she sort of helped stabilise alongside my counselling. So she was able to share with me some of the stuff and thoughts, so I was able to rationalise that. When it came to the conversation, I came to the conversation where it actually started off on a negative front, where he started shouting and effing and blinding around why I wasn't around, why he had to look after mum and dad, and why the moments before dad died that he was doing everything and I wasn't there, etc. I don't know whether it was just that trigger point, but that trigger point was the point where I said, well, this is the reason why. And then I came out with, I got stopped. I stopped some people in London, and this is what they said. And he goes, I had no idea. And I said, I know you didn't. Probably partly my fault for not saying it, but it was to protect me. And he goes, well, I realised that. I would have looked at you in a completely different light. And I was like, no, and it's one of those things.
Years and years.
So I guess that's what been one of my biggest learning experiences, which I share with quite a few people I coach, certainly if they're trying to coach themselves through relationships or any issues that are going on, is to deal with it straight away. And not sort of drag it out, because the longer you leave it, the longer you won't do it. And when you do it, it'll just be the hardest thing that you're doing, I think. And I think that was the turning point in how I dealt with emotions, feelings, putting it in the framework that were given by my counsellor, so that I could process them a lot better in my style. So when COVID did kick in answer to sort of the earlier question, I was a lot more resilient to it. I had the coping mechanisms, I had the strategies available quite quickly to adapt and adapt to the changing times. So every time things changed quite quickly, I was able to quickly adapt to it because I had all the frameworks in place. So, and now, as a coach, I share that with all my coaches that I coach. And that leads on to some of the work I'm doing with children and young people now.
We'll talk about that in a minute as well, before, you know, because obviously it's your time. With your, do you feel that was that, yeah, you said the moment, that was the kind of like the icebreaker, wasn't it, with you? It's funny, isn't it? Because I've spoken on our podcast last week, I think it was, and a couple of weeks ago, and where the guy spoke about the virus, and then he spoke about, he was an American, he was talking about the protests and all this stuff, and he was talking about it being the perfect storm. It was a culmination of all the things happening at once for messages to get out there, imagery, messages and things, and to for people to find out, like, what's being hidden, we've been hiding all these things, all these feelings all along, and all of a sudden, all these things happen to do with the president, to do with the George Floyd thing, to do with the virus, and it was a perfect storm for everything to be mixed out, for everything to be thrown out, and for people to learn about each other. And that's what you would say, that's probably what's happened then. I don't mean perfectly in the fact sense that your dad died, and I'm talking about it happened, your dad died, and then it was all those things, the build-up of...
Yeah, I think the stars aligned. The stars aligned, the planets aligned for everything to come out.
Yes, definitely. And so would you say that was that was a moment, everything came out, you know, and your relationship with your brother getting, in a sense, some sort of semblance and getting better?
Yeah, and, I've done a bit of work on trust and trustworthiness. And I thought I'd never be able to trust my brother. And I thought trust would never be able to get pulled back together. But as I coach people and as I went through that process with my brother, it takes one person that bit of courage to start the process.
Yeah.
And I'm thankful I did, because I know it won't happen straight away. And I know it's not moving on, it's moving forward, because you all still remember what's happened in the past.
Yeah.
But it's around what your relationship is moving forward.
Yeah.
That will count to maintaining and building that trust.
Yeah.
Stronger. It will never be that initial 100% you've had.
Yeah.
It'll always be, I always sort of try and explain it to people in the sense of, it's like having a nice bone china cup. Someone's dropped it. It's cracked, and you've glued it together, and you're now silver lining or gold gilding the cracks slowly, bit by bit, to make it its new, unique relationship product, I guess.
Yeah, and that's actually I think it's in Japan, or one of the things where there's if you break a pottery and they start to line it with gold leaf. That's actually a thing. It's about mending, bringing all the things to make it better, in a sense. And it's never going to be what it was, but it can be actually better than it was in a lot of aspects. What sort of things that you... Let's talk about some of the training that you do, and because you smile a lot and stuff when you start to talk about the training and I'm going to say rest in peace to your father, what some of the things, because you could say that in a sense, he's looking down and he's kind of guiding you on, even though in that funny way of not being there, and he was, his presence in a sense exists, in the sense of you now are able to help others. What, and like you said, you take some of you and put it into your kids and help, because in a set, it's funny, in a conundrum where we don't get the, we don't feel that we're getting that help, or we haven't, but then we use that as a tool to kind of help others. What are some of the things that you're doing with people now, and can you just talk about some of the things that you're doing, some of the aspects to the role that you're doing?
Briefly going on to the roles that I do, and then how I use them to then deliver some of the work that I'm doing. In policing, I'm a federation rep, which is like a union rep for police officers.
Yeah.
So that's within policing. And so outside policing, I'm a trustee for a local charity called Men's Shed that brings men together from the community to do building of carpentry, woodwork, and all those and health and well-being, mindfulness. I'm a school governor for the kids, the school that my kids go to, so I contribute my insight from policing to the school. I also organise a national charity event to remember police officers that have died on duty.
Yeah.
And recognise the charity that supports them. And then I also sit on a national council that safeguards the public from unregulated healthcare workers.
Right.
and all of those sort of coupled together, as well as my own business around coaching and mentoring that I set up just recently, give me the mindset of living a life of service.
Yeah.
So any work that I can contribute to that would add value to helping others either move forward with their work or to add value to the community and protect the community, I will do.
Yeah.
Collectively, over the sort of last year and a half, 2 years, it's sort of slowly, organically building up. I looked at, through policing lens now, the criminals, the bad things that I see now, and dealing with them. I want to go back to the root causes of those and try and deal with them from the root cause.
Yeah.
And beyond the root cause, so the root cause doesn't happen. So one of the things that I've begun to do is working with our youth engagement officers is about developing a coaching and mentoring program for children and young people to get them out of the circle of crime.
Right.
And help them get out of the circle of crime.
Yeah.
So making healthier choices, getting them to see a different paradigm to the paradigm that they're in now.
Yeah.
So that they're around people that encourage the good behaviour and the healthier choices rather than the bad ones, but recognising all the differences that the person brings, identifying the talents in the individuals and giving the people the opportunity to realise those talents. So then I thought, if we can do a programme with there to help and support people get out of the circle of crime, why not go right back and prevent it from happening?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And start looking at 5-year-olds, 6-year-olds, and start creating a journey where they can realise their dreams.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So I'm working with our school at the moment to work out a journey for them through like a coaching, mentoring mindset that they can have a reflective log as they go through. It could be a simple one when they're a kid, like I want to be able to ride a bike, or
yeah, yeah,
I want to be
yeah,
able to kick a football and curl it, or whatever it is.
Yeah.
But it's realizing those goals, recording them, and then growing with it, because it's at that point I feel that kids will be able to, through self-reflection, develop stronger,
yeah,
create mindfulness, develop stronger, being comfortable to share their feelings, have empathy. And if you give them those skills and their framework at that point, and not concentrate on it's about academic stuff, concentrate on what are you at most at your element at, and then let's harness that, because all of the other things will fall into place once you've got that bit done.
Yeah, yeah.
So a classic example, I had a kid that wasn't really into reading, was struggling reading, but really enjoyed football. So I worked with the mum and dad and the kid and gave them football books, football magazines to start reading. And they were able to read, recite all the words, the stats,
yeah, yeah, yeah,
everything about football,
yeah, yeah, yeah,
reading the book, and shared with the parents. I said, look, there isn't an issue around your son reading, because look, he's
reading.
He's just not engaged with the stuff that is being provided. So they can do it. It's just giving them the right platform to operate. And just concentrating on that, and then just helping people go through that journey. So I did, I put my daughter through the sort of framework of the program that I've just got as a skeleton work at the moment. But I've started when she was in year one, so age six, and she's in year six now, age 10, and I sort of put her through the program. It lasted about 9 months, 10 months, and we would have sit down sessions, talk through a couple of the frameworks that I was teaching her, but also what she wanted to get out. But unbeknown to me, during that journey of her, she'd written her own speech to get elected for school council. She'd presented the speech in front of her peers. She got elected. She then got elected as school ambassador. Yeah. She was offering herself to do loads of things for the school, to make the school better. This was a person who was an introvert, silent, wouldn't talk to someone, and completely changed over the period of time. And you see her now, and you see her as a strong female character at school, and has achieved so much more than I would have expected. Beyond, and the teachers have said it. And I think when you look at parallels with her and her peers who have got similar opportunities, similar background, family, etc., even the teachers have seen the difference in mindset. And that made me think, this works. Yeah. This really works. And how can we get this into mainstream education so that every kid has an opportunity that my daughter has had, or the other children that I've supported has had, so that they can realise these dreams? Because, you know, some kids are not academic, but they can improve their academic work by concentrating on some of the stuff that they are at their element. So it's really now creating a growth mindset in children and young people, in education, in areas of where children have made wrong choices and then found themselves in gangs, criminal networks, and trying to help them. Because I think certainly some of the children that I've spoken to, they want to get out of it, but they find it hard because they haven't got the support structure to do it. And if we can find a program that will help get them out of that, I would be, for me, it would be like a fulfillment. It would fulfill me that I've contributed to society, that has helped someone make healthier choices, and helped someone be someone better than they were yesterday.
Yeah, and that's I mean, that's really, it's brilliant what you're doing, and it's not just about catching the bad guy or catching the person who's thinking. It's like you said, it's going back to the root cause of it, and like you say, and then even going back further of helping others not to get into that cycle of whether they get into it or not. It's about showing them a way of not getting to that point where they might get into it, regardless of whether they're from different upbringing, different cultures, different race or whatever. It's about helping children not to see that pathway, and you're right, because I remember as I was a mentor, having worked in schools and worked in organisations over a number of years, one of my main things was similar to what you did or what you're doing now is I remember working as a mentor, and I think that the government has kind of taken that away. They've taken away mentors in school, which was wrong, because what they've done now is just having teachers there running a class, and they're just all academic, and for a lot of children, they're not academically minded, they're not at that place yet, because we're all learning different, even as adults, we're all learning different stages. You know, what might be one stage for you might not be, and people go, oh, well, don't you get it? don't you understand? And you think, well, they probably don't understand because they're not at that level yet. They're not at that level of understanding.
Absolutely.
You get it because your mind is up there, or not up there, or is on a different path. And we know that with children, because we know that children, they learn at different age groups. We know that a girl is more likely to have more in a vocabulary by the age of seven than a boy, because we know that, because as you've spoke about, we don't speak much, so we don't have as much, even at that age, it's genetic, and as well is proven that we don't have that much in our vocabulary, because girls have to have that, because they have to be able to speak to be able to defend themselves as they get older verbally, whereas boys, we defend physical, so we don't have that as much in our makeup, because we don't need it.
I mean, you've answered your initial question around, you know, what is it that makes men, boys, not able to have a sort of mental health, and it is, it's that empathy. And females, girls, women, young ladies, have that in abundance, because part of who they are and what they're prepared for in terms of motherhood, etc., requires it. So they work at it a lot better. I guess those, in terms of men that are actually now beginning to understand it, you can see that almost like a polar opposite of the two men. The one that holds all their feelings, you can tell, is like a transactional command and control type leader. Whereas the sort of coaching, transformational type leader who actually lives and breathes it is the man that has empathy at its roots.
Yeah, definitely. And like I say,
and you can learn that. You can learn that.
Yeah, it's something that you can learn. You can learn to understand others and learn to empathize with us, sympathy as well. And just, you know, when I worked as a mentor, I mean, I used to use all sorts of tools. You know, I used to have games and everything. I used to bring kids together in the room to them talk about their feelings. I used to have kids that were angry. Oh my God. I mean, really angry, to the point where they were throwing things, the slightest thing, and I'd go in and I'd have to, speak to them and coax them. Some of them were, you know, one of the boys is a Jamaican, and he punched. You'd get so angry that you couldn't hold him down or whatever, and they had to take two or three people, and I'd have to go in there and talk to him and calm him down and sit with him, and all sorts. So it's for me. And then there were situations where one of the first things was there was this guy, skinhead, and he had seven or eight kids. You're young. And the teachers were all, you know, the female teachers, and they were all kind of afraid of him. And one of my first jobs was to go out to him. And I went out, I'd never seen him before, never met him before. And I went out to him, and he goes, who are you? And I went, I'm the new mentor. I'm here to look after your, I brought his kid out to him, because they were so afraid to. So I brought the kid out to him, and he goes, who are you? And he goes, I'm such and such, I'm Andrew. I'm the new mentor, I'm here to look after. And he goes, like that. And he kind of went quiet. But then after, there was a situation where I do things like, because some of his kids were struggling physically, mentally or whatever. So sometimes I'd have some of his kids on the football, I put them in the football team based on the fact that to help them build their confidence. I'll have them in sports day or whatever, just to help build their confidence. And then the dad would come and watch. And it came to the point where, when I'd left the job, that he was on Facebook campaigning to keep me he was saying it was this is wrong for me to be leaving, and wrong for, so this person had switched his mindset. You know, I've worked in schools where, in Mansfield, where they had the biggest, where it was the headquarters for the BNP. I worked in schools in there. And when I was first going in, you have the women who come and pick up the kids. After a couple of weeks, you saw the men coming in and they're looking. And I thought, God, that's good, because that means my name is in their household. No matter whether you're racist or not, my name is in your house. And that kid must be saying, there's a new teacher there. He's, there's a new person in school. There's a new teacher. And they're saying, he's black and blah, blah, blah. And so that means you're, do you know what I mean? So that's for me, from where I come from and what the things might bring in, and the things that I've been through, what you're saying there is, and the struggles and mental health and all that sort of stuff, you get success. You got success from the outlet of being bullied and being called racist names to now, you're now able to turn that around and say, well, maybe you're not meant to say that. Maybe you're not meant to call someone that. Maybe you're not meant to do this. And give them advice of helping others and empathy. Before we go, what would you say to somebody who may be struggling now, whether, a young person, what would you say to them couple of lines of struggling with the mental, particularly men or even women, because we have had women on here that are held things back. What would you say?
I think key would be open your mind to support. That would be the classic. I think when people mention counselling, they feel that there's something wrong with them. They think there's an illness. And the power of counselling, I cannot explain how brilliant it is. And if even where I work in policing, where I'm sort of talking to police officers who are quite strong, physically, mentally, minded, that when you mention the topic of counselling, they think it's not for them. And when you sort of, when I open up and say, look, I've had it, and it's had a tremendous impact on my life for the right reasons, they suddenly rethink and they start exploring the opportunity. Yeah. So whoever it is, don't look at counselling as a negative aspect. These are qualified, skilled people, if you get the right person,
yeah,
that are able to help deal with the root issues that are blocking you from moving forward.
Yeah.
And it's at that point when a coach can then take you from moving where you are to moving forward and actually growth mindset and excelling and where you want to be. Because unless you deal with your demons, you can't move forward.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. And where can you... say this, but obviously you spoke about not being, you had people telling that what your door number was and what the colour of your door was. I was going to say, where can you be found? But in terms of social media, if somebody wanted to talk to you and access, you know, your programs, you know, even if it's organisations that maybe wanted to access the program, what would you, where can you be found?
So my company is called Cardia Coaching and Mentoring. I'm on the website, I'm on LinkedIn under my name, Vinny Raggiani, yeah, if there's anyone that needs any support or direction or pointers, by all means go to my website, which is www.cardia, that's Cardia-CM.co.
Thank you for coming on the show and talking about your experiences and you know, you know, it's brilliant what you're doing, absolutely fantastic what you're doing, and you know, all power to you, and you know, hope you, your family, and everybody else is okay in this, in these crazy times. And again, I'd love you to come back on again to talk about even more in depth about your project. I mean, we're kind of just tip of the iceberg there, but maybe talk about, even for a few minutes or whatever, about your projects and successes, because I'd like to hear about that for sure.
Most definitely,
I
mean, we'll stay in touch anyway. I think I'll get a lot of learning out of you as well.
Well, I'm a Liverpool fan, so I'm not sure you'd want to.
we can't all be great.
To be honest with you, I was a big back in the day, I was a big Glenn Hoddle fan, to be honest. I mean, I was a big fan of Glenn Hoddle, so yeah, that bridges a gap somehow.
Well, all my mates at school, ironically, bizarrely, all the Asian kids I used to hang around with at school were all Liverpool fans.
Yeah.
And I was the only isolated Spurs fan at the time. I can remember it. And I always used to say, oh, you're just glory hunting back in the days, you know, the 80s and the 90s. Because I said, what game have you been to? And they'd not been to any games because they were so far away,
living in
London. And I'd had the opportunity. Had the opportunity to go and see all the Spurs games.
It was quite funny.
The glory days. But brilliant.
Thank
you very much for the opportunity of talking.
Yeah, definitely. And that was Men Are Nuts. Speak to you soon.